Across the Pacifica network and over 50 community stations around the country, this is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, May 19, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandes. White House spin man Ari Fleischer suddenly quits his post while news has surfaced that the Pentagon has lost $1 trillion. The Indonesian government has declared martial law in the province of Aceh, and today is the birthday of black nationalist leader Malcolm X. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. There have been 5 suicide bombings in the last 48 hours in the Middle East. The latest, killing 3 Israelis in the northern city of Afula, was carried out by a 19-year-old woman, according to Haaretz. The European Union condemned the series of bombings while calling on Israel to accept the U.S.-backed roadmap for Middle East peace. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has canceled his meeting with President Bush in Washington, D.C., a trip that was slated to begin last night. Sharon has already stated he refuses to dismantle the settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, the first phase outlined by the U.S.-driven roadmap. And the U.S. Supreme Court is refusing an appeal on behalf of the prisoners being held by the U.S. government at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Jay Tamboli reports from D.C.
The Supreme Court announced today that it will not hear the case brought by a group of clergy and lawyers on behalf of prisoners held at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay. Lower courts had thrown out the case, saying the group does not have a strong enough association with the prisoners, whom the Bush administration refers to as detainees, to sue on their behalf. The Supreme Court, without comment, let that ruling stand. Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, has brought a different legal challenge to the detentions, but he faces some of the same issues.
It's been some 15 months now. There's been no access for them to lawyers. There's been no charges against them. In some way, these people have a right to be brought up to some tribunal that can test the legality of their detentions. The United States has not indicated any interest in doing so.
It is estimated that over 600 people are being held at the base, some of them children. Around 50 have been released, mainly due to health problems, but last week 30 more prisoners arrived from Afghanistan. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, this is Jay Tamboli.
Tomorrow, British members of Parliament are expected to introduce and pass legislation that will hold corporations more accountable for deaths caused by their negligence. Anastasia Kershaw has more from London.
New corporate law means that British companies could answer for hundreds of people who die each year due to negligence by managers. It will be an amendment to the Criminal Justice Bill, squeezed in before the final stages of the bill becoming law. It means that if workers or members of the public are killed, it will be easier to convict individual directors and companies. This is seen as a way to stop rebellion among a clique of up to 80 MPs who have been pushing for its inclusion in law. This has been an issue, as the Labour Party manifesto promised such a law before coming to power. Since 1997, 2,000 people have died in Britain due to negligence, but only 4 small firms and 2 directors have ever been convicted. This is Anastasia Kershaw calling from London for Free Speech Radio News.
St. Louis police swept through activists' offices and arrested protesters on the street, hoping to discourage their demonstrations against the World Agricultural Forum. Sevilla Mann reports from St. Louis.
Nearly 300 people attended a peaceful demonstration under heavy police presence outside the World Agriculture Forum's first day of meetings in St. Louis yesterday. The protest was the culmination of a 3-day counterconference to the WAF and a weekend in which the St. Louis police said that potential Seattle-like violence was the reason for sweeping preemptive raids and 20 to 30 arrests that organizers said were highly inappropriate. On Friday morning, police seized a community center where puppets and other materials were stored and had arrested members of a household for inhabiting a building a police officer said was condemned. They arrested bicyclists for violation of a non-existent law against riding a bicycle without a license and passengers in a van en route to the conference on the pretext that pills in the driver's possession might be drugs. Following a publicized rally at the police building, all were released within 20 hours, and some must return for court dates in July. Those attending the counter-conference action say the police activity was a disruption of peaceful and lawful events simply because they were activists. The conference continued as scheduled, and the final event at the World Ag Forum went on without confrontation, as organizers had said it would. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sevilla Mann reporting from St. Louis.
more than 90 Los Angeles police officers will avoid prosecution because the department failed to process the paperwork. From KPFK, Patrick Burke explains.
96 allegedly criminal LAPD officers have escaped prosecution thanks to LA's police investigators, who waited until the statute of limitations had passed before submitting the cases to the district attorney's office. According to the LA Times, hundreds of pages of police and prosecutor records reveal that the officers roughed up citizens, drove drunk, and lied to investigators in a total of 65 cases. One officer allegedly threatened two people with his gun in a drunken holiday brawl. Two others drove to work and reported for duty while drunk, and police records show that another officer assaulted his girlfriend's ex-lover, then forced the man to walk barefoot on broken glass. But these and dozens of other cases were dismissed because the LAPD did not seek charges until the legal deadlines had passed. With KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Patrick Burke for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Ari Fleischer is the minister of disinformation. He's a master of illusion, deception, misdirection. You ask him a question, if he doesn't want to answer, he'll just use it as a platform to give a speech to deliver the administration's line.
That's Russell Mokyber, editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, a White House pool reporter, talking about the sudden resignation of White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer today. Fleischer's announcement comes a year after Karen Hughes, Bush's chief media advisor during the 2000 campaign, also quit her post. Ari Fleischer said, quote, "I informed President Bush last week that after 21 years of doing nothing but government and politics, that I've decided that my time has come to leave the White House." Russell Mokyber again.
A lot of reporters tried, but nobody really got to him. He was unshakable. Of all the times that the reporters tried to get real information, asked tough questions, rarely, if ever, did he give direct, concrete answers. He always dodged, bobbed, and weaved. He did answer questions directly, but not questions that mattered. A couple months ago, he said that the war in Iraq is about the weapons of mass destruction. And when the Washington Post over the last couple of weeks has been reporting that there have been no findings of weapons of mass destruction, he just dodged it and said, well, we're ramping up our efforts to find them.
Russell Mokyber, editor of Corporate Crime Reporter and a White House pool reporter, with thanks to Laura Doggett in D.C. for this segment. Meanwhile, there's a lot happening on Capitol Hill. President Bush plays host to Philippine President Gloria Arroyo today. Public health advocates say they're tentatively encouraged by the government's about-face on the global tobacco treaty. Work could be delayed on the several $100 billion tax cut now before Congress, and the House is considering cutting down trees to save forests, while the Pentagon loses track of $1 trillion. Josh Chaffin has this roundup of news from the nation's capital.
In the wake of bombings in Saudi Arabia, Morocco, and Israel, President Bush and President Gloria Arroyo of the Philippines today pledged further cooperation on anti-terrorism efforts. It's the first state visit to the Bush White House by a head of an Asian nation. Arroyo is seeking trade concessions from the U.S., singling out poverty as a major factor in her country's internal violence. Bush appeared to differ somewhat.
Listen, this nation is committed to dealing with poverty. First, let me make it very clear, poor people aren't necessarily killers. Just because you happen to be not rich doesn't mean you're willing to kill. A lot of the top Al-Qaeda people were comfortable middle-class citizens.
The Homeland Security Department announced today foreign visitors arriving at U.S. airports or seaports beginning January 1st, 2004 will have their travel documents scanned, fingerprints and photos taken, and identification checked against terrorist watch lists. The dollar sank to new lows against the yen and the euro today after Treasury Secretary John Snow signaled the U.S. was happy with a weak dollar. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan testifies before Congress on Wednesday. The Senate is expected to take up the issue of raising the $6.4 trillion debt ceiling this week in order to keep the government from going into default. Both the Senate and the House are preparing to pass legislation approving $400 billion in defense funding with 2 days of debate at most. Meanwhile, a study by the Defense Department's Inspector General finds the Pentagon can't account for more than $1 trillion it spent. The General Accounting Office reports the Army has lost track of 56 airplanes, 32 tanks, and 36 missile launching units. David Williams at a group called Citizens Against Government Waste complains the Pentagon has failed 7 audits in 7 years.
You have an agency that's getting $400 billion. I mean, they're going to eat up, you know, more than half of discretionary spending, and you would hope they could pass an audit. And even the most ardent defense hawks cannot ignore this. Maybe I'm a simpleton, but, you know, airplanes, losing track of an airplane, I can see losing track of a box of pencils or something.
The House looks likely to pass a Bush bill called the Defense Transformation for the 21st Century Act. Among other things, it would create a new personnel system for its 750,000 civilian employees. The General Accounting Office warns Congress against the plan to do away with guaranteed annual salary increases, moving toward a pay-for-performance system. A group called Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility warns the bill would suspend whistleblower protections and authorize no-bid service contracts. The House is also debating the so-called Healthy Forest Restoration Act, a bill by Colorado Republican Scott McInnes that would authorize forest thinning projects through a process that would prevent appeals and lawsuits from environmentalists. It's being sold as a way to prevent forest fire. Amy Mall at the Natural Resources Defense Council says it's a giveaway to the logging industry.
It would waive our environmental laws and just make it a lot easier for a lot more logging to be done of our larger and older trees, the trees that we really need to keep.
In a surprise reversal, Secretary of Health and Human Services Tommy Thompson says the Bush administration now supports the global anti-tobacco treaty that the administration and tobacco companies had up to now opposed. The treaty would seek to ban tobacco advertising and cigarette sales to minors worldwide. Public health advocates like George Washington University professor John Banshaf say they're wary the president could still choose not to ratify the treaty.
I was very gladdened by this development. I think there are things going on behind the scenes which prompted Tommy Thompson to make this abrupt about-face, and I hope that he stays with his current position.
What do you think's going on behind the scenes?
Can't comment on that.
The Congressional Memorial Day recess starts Friday. Work on reconciling the House's $550 billion tax cut bill with the Senate's $350 billion package could be put off until Congress comes back June 3rd. Before the recess begins, unions are asking Congress to commit $16 billion to jobless benefits. As of May 31st, 80,000 laid-off workers will lose their jobless benefits every week. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington, D.C.
Today, the Indonesian government declared what many have described as all-out war on the province of Aceh, imposing martial law and giving the Indonesian military, now estimated to be close to 50,000 in Aceh, full control over civil law, leaving many human rights observers fearing the military will act with complete impunity. Iggy Kim is with Action in Solidarity with Indonesia. He commented on this latest move by Jakarta.
It's even a further extension of military rule in Aceh. Aceh has been subjected to constant attacks and harassment by the Indonesian military for some time now, and the declaration of martial law makes that much more comprehensive. I guess it gives them much more formal authority to suspend any vestige of civil rights and allows the military to have full control over the daily social affairs of the Achenese people. And that's very frightening when you consider that thousands of people already have lost their lives to the Indonesian military.
And Jakarta says that they're imposing this martial law because of the breakdown in the peace talks between the GAM rebels, that's the Free Aceh movement, and the government of Megawati Sukarnoputri. Is this really the reason?
How sincere the Indonesian government was is revealed by the arrest of five of the Free Aceh movement negotiators on Friday. These negotiators were making their way to the Aceh airport, Banda Aceh airport, in order to go to Tokyo for these talks, and they were arrested. They were then allowed to take part in the talks via telephone in Aceh, and then they were promptly rearrested once that had finished.
Iggy Kim, it's very interesting that this is all escalated almost on the eve of East Timor's one-year anniversary of independence, and there have been a lot of comparisons made between the nation of East Timor and the province of Aceh, and we're even looking at facts that say that the army and the police are profiting handsomely, the Indonesian army and police, from actually being in Aceh, and that Indonesia's national budget brings in much resources from Aceh. Can you talk about why Aceh is so profitable to the Indonesian government?
It's incredible how much the rest of Indonesia profits from Aceh, actually. Aceh is only a very, very small portion of the Indonesian landmass, but it is incredibly rich in oil and gas reserves. Japanese consortium and the U.S. corporation ExxonMobil have established gas and oil operations in Aceh, and the TNI are involved in protection rackets with these foreign multinationals.
Just to clarify, the TNI is the Indonesian National Military.
They are also involved in a whole range of quite sordid business activities, ranging from rackets in illegal logging, illegal fishing, through to prostitution and drug rackets. Aceh has been enormously profitable. So you can understand that the TNI does not want to let go. But more than that, there's more at stake here. There is actually a division within the Indonesian elite over its strategy in Aceh. There is a large section of the ruling elite that actually does not want the TNI to go in there and carry out a full-scale war. They are very dubious and skeptical of the TNI's ability to succeed in such a venture after having witnessed what happened in East Timor, and therefore fear that a TNI full-scale war will actually further destabilize Indonesia's rule over Aceh. However, no one is willing or game enough to stop the TNI from doing what it's doing.
Iggy Kim with Action in Solidarity with Indonesia. 20 Indian fishermen were released from prison in Pakistan yesterday following peace initiatives between the two countries. For the families of hundreds of fishermen in western India, the peace initiatives recently taken by India and Pakistan are welcomed as more than 300 fishermen languish in Pakistani jails and three in Indian jails. The Pakistani Prime Minister has promised, in response to the Indian Premier's offer of peace, to return the fishermen caught in Pakistani waters. The everyday travesty for poor fishing families is that as they are caught in a struggle to survive, earning what money they can from fishing, they are also in great danger of unknowingly trespassing sea borders. Binu Alex reports from one coastal town in western India where there are many families torn apart with fishermen who are languishing in Pakistani jails.
It's a long wait for 32-year-old Devi Siddhi, whose face lit up as she heard from the TV news next door about the possibility of bilateral talks between India and Pakistan.
I have put the faith in the Almighty, and for me, government is the Almighty. They have to help out. Now the only faith that I have is the peace talks.
Devi's husband was caught as he ventured for fishing from the western coastal town of Diu. More than 319 like him are in the Pakistan jails, where they have also been victims of alleged torture. Their only crime, to have entered Pakistan waters knowingly, but in many cases, unknowingly. But fishermen like Ramji Selat asserts that distances are not earmarked on water, nor do they have the devices to position themselves.
We have no idea where we are, only sea above and water below. We calculate on the basis of hours traveled, and at times we end up being caught.
Teenager Harish Mandan was lucky that he was let off after Pakistan Marine sympathized with him and four aged fishermen who were caught with him.
They let us off after seeing that we will not withstand their torture.
For each shot that Indian cricket players hit Pakistani bowlers in cricket, these fishermen are inflicted the blow by the jail authorities in Pakistan. For millions of uploads that Indian spectators witness in most popular game of India, these fishermen report that they suffer terribly. They suffer because India has beaten Pakistan in a World Cup preliminary match. In Diu, only the 8-year-old Yagnik, out of the four children of Devi and Ramu Siddhi, knows that his father is in jail.
Pakistan.
Kim?
He is in Pakistan. He was caught while fishing. Don't know when he'll return.
Fishing for this family, like all the families who live in this area, is the sole source of income. As tears rolled out of the impoverished cheeks of his mother, Yagnik could not console her. If there are 319 in Pakistani jails, There are 93 in Indian jails too. Gujarat has the richest fishing ground in Asia and the largest coastline in India, where nearly 2.5 million fishermen are engaged in the production capacity of 800,000 million metric tons. 77-year-old Premji Khokri is an activist of National Fish Workers Forum of India.
There should be some parameters for the confinement. If they commit mistakes of entering Pakistan waters, they should be reprimanded. These innocents have not committed any murder. Why are they kept like criminals? No solution is in sight except common zone. Both countries can look to the Sri Lanka agreement.
But fishermen like Premjibhai Solanki complains that the Indian and Pakistani authorities have not taken seriously the Pakistan Prime Minister's offer to release the fishermen.
I have written so many letters, from the Prime Minister to the Home Minister. But releasing of fishermen is not their priority. We will starve if this attitude of the government continues.
As the strong currents bounce the vessels that are anchored till next season begins after the monsoons, the initiatives have given new lease of hope to the families who have nothing to do except watching the high tides till their siblings return. From the coastal towns of Gujarat and Diu, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Haitians in New York yesterday joined in the celebration with Haitians all over the world to mark the historic anniversary of 200 years of independence from French rule. Yet as they celebrate, many Haitians remain in detention with the U.S. Immigration Service. Ian Forrest reports.
Haitian master drummer Bonga at the Brooklyn Museum. For many who came out to celebrate the island nation's independence from colonial domination some 200 years ago, it was a time for reflection on what it meant to be Haitian. Among them were two women now living in New York, Margaret Duval and Higgins Remy.
It means to be proud, and it also means that we have a long road ahead with our struggle on all fronts. But if we stick together, we can definitely prevail.
I am so proud to be Haitian, very proud of my history, but looking to do some things different for the future so that we can continue to pass our traditions to our children.
Ninaj Raoul attended yesterday's celebration and is with Haitian Women for Haitian Refugees, an advocacy group based in Brooklyn, New York. Speaking from the background of her work with immigrants in detention in the U.S. Northeast, Raoul finds it ironic that while Haiti marks the celebration of its freedom, so many Haitians in the U.S. remain locked up, oftentimes transported from as far away as the Chrome Detention Center in Florida.
They placed them in these places for as much as $168 a day, and where they're far away from any kind of advocacy structure that could be set up, legal advocacy structure, far away from family members that would be able to apply for them to parole them or even just visit them.
And in Florida, where most Haitian boat refugees first land, Marlene Bastien of the Haitian Women of Miami says that of the over 200 Haitians, men, women, and children, who came ashore on October 29 last year, some 54, mostly men, remain in detention. The others being sent back to Haiti, while a number of them remain in the U.S. processing asylum claims. Bastien sees great discrepancy in the treatment of Haitian vis-a-vis that of Cuban refugees.
Haiti has never been and is not on the list of countries that harbor terrorists. Cuba is, and yet Cubans are allowed here in this country every day. Not only that they come by boat, they come on raft, but they also hijack planes with arms, they hijacked boat with arms, and then they are allowed in. Yet Haitians are being denied release on bond, and even Haitians who have obtained political asylum have remained in jail on the premise that they are a threat to national security.
For groups like the Haitian Legal Aid Fund, their efforts to raise money to post bonds for Haitians at Chrome Detention Facility have virtually come to a standstill. This, according to Kathy Clarich, a spokesperson for the Haitian Legal Aid Fund, as a result of the legal roadblocks instituted by the Justice Department.
Halif is at a real crossroads. We still have a tremendous amount of support from the community, and we're in the process now of trying to figure out what our next step should be. We're certainly interested in advocacy. We think the policy needs to be changed. We're also interested in getting the word out to the community because we think the more people who know about this, the more outrage and then the more pressure there would be to change the policy.
Support from the political directorate in Florida for the plight of the Haitians still in detention at Chrome is expected to add greatly to the case for their release that advocate Marlene Bastien and others will be taking to the nation's capital in early June. Reporting for FSRN, I am Ian Forrest.
Across the U.S. today, many communities are celebrating Racial Justice Day to coincide with the birthday of African-American civil rights leader Malcolm X. The black community is still struggling today with the many issues for which Malcolm X fought. Here, he talks of the conditions in the ghetto.
And these overcrowded conditions under which our people are forced to live eliminates all chance for a normal home, for a clean home, or for a healthy home.
Our commentator on Death Row, Mumia Abu-Jamal, reflects on the life of Malcolm X on this, his birthday.
It has been almost 40 years since the assassination of Malcolm X, and the influence of the black nationalist leader continues to grow, particularly among generations that were not alive when he was in the thick of his advocacy. While some of this is no doubt due to the powerful film done by the black filmmaker Spike Lee, it's also true that the writings of Malcolm X continue to be read, as does the popular autobiography penned by the late Alex Haley. One particularly remarkable example of the continuing influence of Malcolm X may be seen in the recent case of the young man John Walker Lynn, who came to be known derisively as Johnny Taliban. Lynn, who converted to Islam and went to live and fight among the Taliban government in Afghanistan, traced his Islamization to his reading of the Alex Haley work. Among the so-called hip-hop generation too, the imagery of Malcolm, as shown by the reproduction of photos of the slain leader adorning some rap albums, or imitations of famous poses adopted by some rappers as covers for their own albums, can be seen. Students of the Black Panther Party should know that the organization perceived itself, in its earliest days, as a realization of the deeply held dreams of the late Muslim leader. BPP founder Huey P. Newton would later write, quote, "Although Malcolm's program for the Organization of Afro-American Unity was never put into operation, he has made it clear that blacks ought to arm. Malcolm's influence was ever present. We continue to believe that the Black Panther Party exists in the spirit of Malcolm, ever present," unquote. Today, as Malcolm's life is performed on screen by the brilliant Denzel Washington, and the U.S. Postal Service has even issued a stamp in his honor, much of Malcolm's experience as a dissident is lost in Time's translation. The government that now speaks his name with praise once saw him as its greatest threat. Everywhere Malcolm spoke, there too were the spooks from the FBI, writing down notes or taping his speeches. Although they labeled him as a hate monger, it was clear that it was the government that used its awesome powers to act on their hatred against black Americans, and particularly those black leaders and spokespersons who opposed the repressive status quo. It's good to remember Malcolm for the positive lessons that continues to radiate from his life. It is also good to remember that this government opposed him and his colleagues, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, for example, using every resource, fair and foul, to destroy them and their movements. Next time you see a stamp, remember. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.